At what point in dealing with the police can anything you do or say be used against you? I'm Jabalani LaFault, and on today's Central Standard, a lawyer's guide to handling police interrogations. Our guest hopes to narrow the gap between what citizens know and what police know about your rights. He will be taking your questions, too. Plus, later in the hour, Robert Lighton, economist and executive at the Kauffman Foundation, will share his memories of his oil man father's true passion, painting and sketching and lithographs, which are now on display at the Kansas City Public Library downtown branch. That's all coming up on today's Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. If you've ever had flashing lights in your rearview mirror, or been involved in a routine traffic stop, or had an officer of the law walking slowly toward you during an incident, the first instinct might be to think about, what am I gonna say? Our guest today says, be quiet. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Joining us now is Prince Adebayo Ogunmeno, who runs the Ogunmeno Law Firm. He's the author of Silence is Power, a lawyer's step-by-step guide to handling police interrogations and protecting your freedom. Prince Adebayo Ogunmeno, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you.
Now, you're a prince.
Yes.
An actual prince from Nigeria, the Yoruba tribe.
Yes.
So how far are you in the lineage from being king?
Well, I'm pretty close to be a king, but we have a sitting king right now, and that's for life.
And he's pretty much king for life, so you're going to do the lawyer thing.
Yeah.
For this time being.
Yes, and we're just waiting. And I hope he have a long life. He's healthy. I saw him about 2 months ago, so.
You got a chance to chat with him?
Yes, and took pictures.
What did he have to say?
Oh, well, he welcomed me because I haven't seen him in about 6 months, so that was his thing.
Well, let's start with the other thing you're the prince of, legal defense. Yeah. And let's start with an example. Let's say you're pulled over by a law enforcement officer, and they say what you commonly hear during a routine traffic stop: do you know why you were stopped? What do you say to that?
Well, two things you can do. You can say no.
Or, no.
Yes.
Or that's it.
No, that's it.
What if you know you were speeding, or if you just had a boulevard wheat?
You can still say no, because you don't know the reason why the officer stopped you.
Right.
You might speculate why he stopped you, but you don't know. He might be stopping you for something different.
So you're saying, just say no, and you get that awkward silence like I'm sure our listeners just had a minute ago. No? What do you mean no? So what's next? What if the officer gets mad and says, well, step out of the car? Then what do you do?
Yeah, you have to comply with the officer's request. You step out of the car, but while you are stepping out of the car, you can lock your car.
You have the right to lock your car when you step out of it.
Yes.
Why do that?
Because your car is your property. You, the owner of the property, and, you know, just like the case that was decided yesterday by the Supreme Court, you have a property right in that car, and nobody else can get in it without your permission.
You're speaking of a Supreme Court case involving search and seizure.
Yes.
And what was the important finding in that case?
Well, basically, it was a GPS that the police went and attached under the car. And then they used that to track the person, the owner of the car, as he drive all over town for about a month. And the evidence they collected, they used it against him in the case. Before the trial, they have already filed a motion to suppress the evidence, but it was overruled, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court.
So to avoid a tiff with an officer who might be having a bad day or just wants to be aggressive or wants to assert their authority, like sometimes you might find, isn't it just best to be nice and comply with what the officer's saying? Why would you clam up? and risk a confrontation?
Well, you are not climbing up. You are actually exercising your right, your constitutional right, to be free from illegal search. And because you are exercising your right, the officer has no right. That's why they ask you the question.
So that's why they say, do you mind
yes.
if we search your car?
Yes.
And what are your rights in that situation?
You tell them no.
And then what do you do next if they say, well, you know, step out of the car, why don't you want me to search your car? Have you done anything illegal?
You don't have to answer those questions.
You don't have to answer any of those questions. Was there a particular case, Prince Ugumuno, that made you want to do this book?
Well, I'm not going to say one particular case, but it's cumulative of cases. I've been practicing for over 15 years at that time. Now I've been practicing for over 20 years. So I've encountered a lot of cases where my client, you know.
They talk too much.
Yeah. They've talked to the police. And whenever you talk to the police, your case becomes harder. It becomes tough. But when you don't talk to the police, that's your right not to talk. And that's what I will tell people now. The advice they give you, that anything you say will be may be used against you. It should be say anything you say will be used against you in the court of law. So that's why you don't say much.
So people don't particularly listen to that.
Well,
you get told that when you read your rights, but people are still saying, well, wait, I didn't do anything. And you said after they hear their rights, or even before they hear their rights, they should say nothing.
That's right. You just say no. And if they say, I want to search your car, you say no. And then you come out of your car. If they say, come out of your car, you come out of your car. You lock your car. Now, unless they find something looking through the window, they have no probable cause to search your car.
Along the lines of what our guest in here, our in-studio guest, Prince Adebayo Ugumuno, says, he's an attorney, a criminal defense attorney. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled 9-0 Monday, requiring law enforcement officials to obtain a search warrant before they can attach a GPS tracking device to a vehicle. So that's a victory for rights that our guest brought up. Why is silence power?
Well, because it will do you good, especially in both criminal cases and even civil cases, in cases where you are stopped for shoplifting or things of that nature. Because by talking,
anything can be used against you.
Yes, exactly. And by the time you get to a lawyer, you may have already given away your rights.
How do you exercise your legal right, though, Prince Ugumuno, without invoking anger at an officer at the scene and facing potential obstruction of justice charges or resisting arrest charges or probable cause that they're going to say or whatever they can throw against you in the moment for asserting those rights? There are plenty of instances when those rights are violated anyway.
That's true. But the way you do that is to just be calm.
Stay calm.
Yes, stay calm. They ask you questions, unless they are asking questions about your identity. Of course, they will say, give me your driver's license. Yeah, you give them the driver's license. You don't have to talk. Actually, I can give you one example that happened to me myself after I wrote the book.
Okay, break it down right after you finish the book. What happened?
Yes, that was in L.A.
In L.A.?
Yes, December 26, 2009.
You get stopped by a cop in L.A.?
Yes.
Wow. That's
well,
not common.
Actually, I wasn't stopped. They were doing road block.
Right.
So we were coming from Kwanzaa.
Right.
Early in the morning. And I thought, you know, the people in the car thought they were doing doing movie shooting and stuff like that.
Did he tap your window and say, hey, are you coming from Kwanzaa? Did he ask you that?
Well, no. When it was our turn, I mean, there was a car in front of me. So when it was my turn, she came to me and said, have you been drinking? I didn't answer the question because I don't have to answer the question. Then she said, have you had anything to drink? Still, I didn't answer the question. So she asked me that question four times. I didn't answer the question. Then she said, okay, give me your driver's license. And the vehicle, it was a rental car, so I gave her the vehicle. She looked, and the lady in the car, I already told them that I'm going to use the information that I have in the book. And she said, no, don't do that because we are in L.A., you get killed.
Right.
And she was, you know, the lady and the children in the car, they were so nervous. I said, don't worry, nothing's going to happen. And then when I didn't answer the question, I gave her my driver's license. She looked at it and she gave me my driver's license back and said, you are free to go.
Now, could you reveal, just between you and me, in this private studio, were you drinking that day? You have the right.
I don't have to answer that question. Plus, the other thing is, your question is so vague. You are talking about that day. That's 24 hours.
Right.
So
that's typical lawyer speak. That's typical legal semantics there. That's a very good job.
You asked me, have I been drinking? Yes, I could have been. Am I going to say I haven't drink water all day?
Right.
See?
Right. Because I didn't ask you specifically what you had been drinking.
Exactly. So that's why you have to be careful. And that's why you don't have to answer these questions. Because if you say yes, we don't know what you are saying yes to.
Now, could she have then, in that case, on this Kwanzaa celebration in question, on that day where you may or may not have taken drink, could she have ordered a breathalyzer test anyway? Could she have said, can you refuse to take a breathalyzer test?
No, you can't. You cannot refuse to do that if they claim that they have probable cause. But that day probably would be zero.
Now, what counts as probable cause? Because this is pretty much up to the discretion of the officer at the scene. So what counts?
Well, that's the problem.
The problem that is the discretion of the officer at the scene.
Yes. So, because in that case, you can say, oh, I smell alcohol, I smell whatever. And, you know, like we are talking on the radio, how can you smell anything?
You're listening to the Everything You Want to Know About Your Legal Rights, but we're too handcuffed or too afraid to ask. Our guest is Prince Adebayo Ugumeno, who runs the Ugumeno Law Firm. He's the author of Silence is Power, A Lawyer's Step-by-Step Guide to Handling Police Interrogations and Protecting Your Freedom. Kansas City, do you actually know your basic rights as citizens, your Miranda rights, your routine traffic stops? Now's the time to call in and ask what's real and what's urban legend. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org or on Facebook or on Twitter at KCURCST. Again, the number is 816-235-2888. Free legal advice if you're out there right now. Some of you might be listening in your car and the lights are flashing behind you right now. And you say, excuse me, officer, I need to listen to Jawalani LaFall. He's got a guest on. I'm going to be quiet now. Could he say that?
Yes.
Boom.
Scott, the only thing is, if they ask you for a driver's license, you give it to them.
Right. And then keep listening to Central Standard, exactly. 89.3 KCUR. Scott in KC asks, the advice so far seems to be to assist people who are possibly involved with illegal activities, is what Scott says. For the rest of us who obey laws and have nothing to hide, why should we be defiant to the police? Tell them,
well,
Prince.
You are not defiant to the police.
You're asserting your right.
Exactly.
Why is there such a perception among listeners such as Scott that asserting your right, that saying, no, you can't search my car, or saying, no, I'm not going to tell you if I'm drinking or not, or saying, I'm just going to give you my license, I'm going to be quiet, I'm going to step out and lock my vehicle because you have no right to search my car. How come asserting your rights are considered defiant by so many people, cops and citizens included? Like, they must be hiding something. What's up with that perception?
Well, I believe the problem is maybe morality, or what your parents has been telling you, that if you don't do anything, you tell them you don't do anything. However, the law is different from morality, as everybody knows. When you get into the court of law, it's not what your moral thinks is.
Right.
It's what the law says.
Or what you know, it's what you can prove.
Exactly. So if you start talking and then you now come back and say, oh, that's not how it is, well, whatever evidence is before the court is what they are going to use. And people think, oh, national instinct. Oh, I want to prove myself.
Right.
That, but the police is not the judge.
Right.
So they are not the one who is going to decide the case.
They're just going to write it down on their report. And as they say in the street, you could end up snitching on your own self.
Exactly. It's they're going to write it down, and they're going, and they are independent.
Right.
They can't do anything
right.
for you. So if you didn't answer the question, the only thing they can do is that's why they go to the judge.
Prince Adebayo, why do people tend to give up their rights? Is it fear? Fear of reprisal from the police?
Well, yeah, that might be part of it. And also it might be natural instinct because they want to prove they didn't do anything wrong.
Kind of like Scott and KC saying, these are people, if you're not involved in illegal activities, why not just comply?
But the problem is, for example, Scott is talking about a criminal setting. But if we come to a civil setting, you went to the mall and you are stopped for shoplifting. You didn't shoplift it. You didn't steal anything, but you are stopped. Well,
right.
Of course, you know, people are looking, you are embarrassed, but you still want to prove that you didn't steal anything. You don't have any duty to prove that you didn't steal. Okay, now they have accused you of that. If you tell them, oh, you can search my bag, you can do this, you can do that, search myself. And they did, and they didn't find anything, and they say, okay, thank you, you can go. Now, you think about it, you are upset, you are mad, okay, I'm going to sue them, you know, what they did is not right. By the time you come to me, you already give away your right. Because the law says, since you consent to
a search or whatever,
to that search, you have no more rights.
We got FISA in KC Mo. Welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you.
You got a question for us?
Yeah, I have a question. I'm a female, and I don't like when a male tells me that he wanted to touch me if I'm stopped by a police officer. So if I requested that, can I get a female? Do I have that right?
Does she have the right to wait on a female officer to come to the scene if there's a male officer requesting to search her person, Prince Adebayo?
Yeah, like putting a handcuff on me. I don't want a male to touch me.
Right.
Yes, they can ask, and most of the police department do that anyway if they want to search. But they can still pat you down to find out that you don't have any.
So it's not a legal right to say, don't touch me. I'd rather have a woman patrol person search me. It's not the legal right to do that.
Well, not entirely a legal right, but they can still pat you down to make sure that you don't have any weapon. But if they want to really search you and put hand in, you know, in private places, then yeah, you can request that you want a female officer.
And that comes as a violation, and could come as a violation in a civil proceeding if that person wants to press charges.
Well, that's a technical question.
Speaking of other technical questions, what is qualified immunity?
Well, qualified immunity is a situation where the public officer, not only the police officer, public officer do certain things within their job. You know, for example, a police officer stop you, they have a right to stop you. However, if you tell them they can't search your car and they search it by force, they might lose that qualified immunity, because now, unless they have probable cause, they don't have a right to search your car without your consent.
But then the burden of proof would be on you as a plaintiff's attorney suing a police department or filing criminal charges against the police department to prove that they overstepped their bounds in searching your car when you said, don't search my car.
Yeah, and that's why I noted in the book that there's a strategy you can use to protect yourself in that. Usually the police car have
a camera
and is recording. So when they tell you to come out of the car And sometimes they have a speaker attached to their uniform. And so when you are talking and you are talking back, it's being recorded. So hopefully that's functioning. And sometimes they can say it's not, they can't find it or they destroy it. But that's another technical issues that you deal with when you are in court.
Can you subpoena the camera evidence, or can you subpoena walkie-talkie transcripts or computer images as a criminal or civil defense attorney? Can you subpoena that?
Yes, if you have a criminal defense case going on, yes, you have a right to that. Actually, the prosecutor will provide that to you. If you're in the civil setting, yes, you have a right to subpoena it. And
but sometimes they lose it, is what you're saying.
Well, yeah, sometimes they claim that it's lost or it's overwritten and they've over-recorded on it and stuff like that.
This is the Miranda Rights Routine Traffic Stops, Your Basic Rights call-in show on Central Standard with Prince Adebayo Ugumenu. He's a lawyer with the Ugumenu Law Firm. He's author of Silence is Power, a lawyer's step-by-step guide to handling police interrogations and protecting your freedom. Jim and Grandview, welcome to Central Standard.
Yeah, hi, this is Jim. I actually live in Lee Summit. I just wanted to share with you that I agree with the Prince completely. My friends actually find it very entertaining to go shopping with me because every time I go to a store and somebody asks to see my receipt or asks to look in the bag, I 100% refuse. I've had the police called on me. And it's always the same. Well, except for one exception, it's always been the same. Well, if you didn't have anything to hide, you wouldn't mind us looking. And I said, well, I'd be more than happy to let you look in my bag. Well, to the police, I tell them, if you have a warrant, yes, you may do so. To the store owner or manager or whatever, I tell them, you may look in my bag, but it will cost you $1,000 because that's my price for usurping my rights. And they try to tell me that they don't have to do that. And and for my friends, it's very entertaining. But the bottom line is, I agree with Benjamin Franklin, and it's your right. I paid for it. I don't have anything to hide. And it's on them to prove that I've had something to, you know, that I've stolen something. So that's how it goes. And I've had people grab me, and I've asserted that, you know, that's battery. And I've had the police come in, and I tell them the same thing. If you have a warrant, you may look. And to me, I don't understand why people allow themselves to be searched like that. They just, it's wrong.
Jim, you're a regular desperado. Thank you for calling in to Central Standard. Do you agree with Jim, Prince Adebayo Ugumenu?
Exactly. I agree with him completely because he's doing the right thing. And, yeah, in those instances, he can bring a civil suit.
What are some fundamental things that most people don't understand or don't take advantage of when they're either being read their rights or they're out in a store like Jim? What are people missing? You said earlier that perhaps some people comply out of fear. Some people comply out of some sort of moral compass, but maybe there's a group of people or a segment of people that comply simply because they don't know. What is the fundamental thing, Prince Adebayo, that people don't know about their rights?
That's it, is that they don't think they can tell the police officer no. They don't think that they can tell the police officer you can't search my bag. They don't think that they can do it, and if they do it, they'll be in trouble. Or they can morally say, oh, why go through that trouble when you can just simply show that you didn't do anything and you go on your way? And the law expects you to know your right. And that's why the police take advantage of people. The other part of it is psychology. I mean, the police, we think, oh, well,
they got a big shiny bear, they got the stick, they got the gun.
Right. And they think, oh, well, if you don't do anything, why don't you tell us and you can be on your way? But sometimes you won't be on your way.
Kate writes in, quote, my husband was pulled over 2 or 3 times a week by our local police for reasons such as you were swerving or you are suspicious or your lights over your license plates aren't bright enough. He is kept for 4 to 6 hours on the side of the road and does not receive a ticket, What are his rights in cases such as these? Sounds like they kind of have a cop show sort of vendetta against Kate's husband here. What are Kate's husband's rights in that scenario?
Well, I have to know more about that.
More about the specifics of what they think might be probable cause?
Right. And if you tell them no, they have a right to keep him there, to go get a warrant to search his car. But they still have to have initial probable cause, and sometimes they don't. And that's why the officer asks you, do you know why I stopped you? Because they want you to incriminate yourself.
Right. Here's an interesting tidbit out of your book that if you watch too many cop shows, you might get it a little bit twisted on it. Police do not have to show you a search warrant before they enter your home. Is that true?
That's true. They can tell you they have a warrant.
And they don't have to show it to you?
They don't have to show it to you.
So what's the best thing to do in that case? Now, you said with a traffic stop, you can get out the car with your keys and lock the door and say, nope, can't search my vehicle. But if they're at your house and they say they got a warrant and they don't have to show you one, what do you do?
Well, you just let them go through the search. And then after that, call your lawyer and see if they really have a search warrant when they told you they did. And if they don't, then you might have a claim.
Ed in Lacine, Kansas. Ed, welcome to Central Standard.
Yeah. My question is, if you're sitting in a private parking lot, such as a gas station or whatever, and you're sleeping in your car, does a police officer have a right to stick his head in your window?
Does he have the right to stick your head in the window? That's maybe probable cause, maybe suspicious activity. I don't know.
Yes, they might have if it's a private and maybe the people call to see what's going on in the car. The police call it welfare investigation. You know, they want to see if you are...
Public safety.
Yes, you are all right and everything. So they can look and stick, but they can't stick their head inside
your car. They can't.
They can't.
So they couldn't in that case, but what Ed is talking about, ask to search the car.
Well, if they do, then you can still tell them no.
You can still tell them no even if you're in a gas station sleep in the middle of the night.
Right, because unless they find something in what they call open field, something that they can see. But if they can't see it, you can still tell them no, they can't search your car.
And by open field, you mean open field of vision, within their vision.
Yes, within their vision. Anything under the seat or in the glove compartment or in your trunk is not open.
Max writes, I was stopped once by a police in a traffic stop in KCMO. With my driver's license, the police officer asked me, what is my social security number? Do they have a right to ask for a social security number?
Yeah, they have, because that's part of your identification, because they can use that to, you know, log in into their computer
and get the rest of your information.
Yes. So, yeah, that's part of your bio.
Jeffrey in Topeka, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty good.
I want to know if they're able to record me, am I allowed to get out and turn my voice recorder on at the same time that might be in my pocket? Or if I have a camera in the car, can I let it
can
run
you get
and
out
record?
And can you get out and turn on a camera on the police, okay. Prince Adebayo?
Yeah, the answer is probably yes, because that camera is your property. And if you want to turn it on, yes. But if they see it, they might want to seize it. That's an issue that you have to deal with.
Are they within their right, if they see your camera, to say, I'm just going to set this on the hood while we talk, officer, is that cool? Do they have a right to seize your personal property then in a routine traffic stop?
Probably not.
Probably not.
Yeah.
How would you argue a case? Is there any precedent for that? How would you argue that case?
Well, the problem is it illegal to have a camera? Are you using it for illegal purposes? I would say no. And if you're not using it for illegal purposes, then they have no right to seize your property.
Prince Adebayo, a lot of what we've encountered today from listeners and from people who wrote into centralstandard@kcur.org has involved routine traffic stops or searches. What do you recommend, given all the stuff that's been going on with Occupy KC, Occupy Wall Street, protesters all over the country? What do you recommend rights-wise for protesters or marchers who may be accosted by the police? have you explored rights in that area? I mean, you mentioned in your book, be silent everywhere. So what would you tell a protester or marcher who is in the public streets?
Well, they can't violate the law.
They can't violate the law,
no.
Certainly.
Yeah, so they can go by their way.
What about
their business?
So be quiet if you're being detained?
Yes.
Is that basically what you're...
The officer come to you and say, hey, what are you doing there? You don't have to answer that question. But if you say, oh, can you give me your identification? Yes, you give the identification and the rest of it, anything that doesn't have, is not related to your identification, you don't have to answer the question. And if you don't, they don't have a right to force you to answer.
Are there any circumstances other than perhaps basic information where you actually would need to talk to a cop? And if so, when would that be?
Unless you're a victim. And if you're a victim, you also need to be careful. Because, you know, you can't tell them lies that something that is not true. So that's one thing. And the other part of it is this Miranda warning. Some people have confusion about that. They think, oh, the officer didn't give me Miranda warning. Where the law is changing is, you know, they don't have to give you Miranda warning sometimes unless you are under detention. But I can tell you, technically, when the police officer stop you, you are under arrest. Period.
You're technically under arrest when yeah. you're stopped.
Yes. Period.
Under the auspices of probably or could or having violated a law
right.
to be pulled over in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine police don't stop people every time. So when you are stopped, you are technically under arrest. So anything you use at that time can be used against you. Anything you say can be used against you. So people think that, oh, they didn't read me my Miranda right, and they were asking me all these questions. Don't answer the questions.
That doesn't necessarily matter anymore. You said the law with Miranda rights and being read your rights is changing. How so?
Well, because they are talking about investigatory stop. You know, the officer is not interrogating you. They are just stopping you. Or they call people, you know, person of interest. Or somebody they just want to talk to you. Well, it doesn't go that way.
So you're talking about investigatory stuff or probable cause stuff or person of interest stuff or suspect stuff. Mm. Along those lines, Prince Adebayo, has a new era of terrorist investigations or long-term investigations of problem areas in cities such as Kansas City, Missouri, racial profiling, certain suspects fitting a certain description, has that changed anything in terms of the way of rights are inferred or denied?
I don't believe so. No, it hasn't changed anything because you still have a right not to talk. The Constitution has not been changed. The law has not been changed. The Supreme Court decision has not been changed. So everything is still where it is, and you still have that right not to talk. And if they insist on talking to you, then you say, hey, I won't talk to you unless my lawyer is here. If they ask you all those questions and you don't answer it, you can tell them, hey, I won't talk to you until my lawyer is here. And I've have several experiences where some clients, you know, the police themselves use silence as power because they were interrogating the client and I was in the room with that client and they leave us in the room for maybe 20 minutes.
Prince Adebayo, we did get a call in from Kate who wrote in earlier talking about her husband being pulled over 2 to 3 times a week. We followed up asking why she thought he might be a target. She explained, we think it's because he's Arab American. It is the same group of cops that pulls him over. He thinks they're waiting for him on his way home from work. They take his driver's license and info and then just leave him sitting in the car for hours. So she thinks it might be racial intimidation. What should Kate do?
Well, they need to file a complaint with that police department.
If it happens enough, file a complaint.
Yes. And see what the investigation is going to be. They call citizen complaint.
Racial profiling, that's very common with some of your clients?
Yes, it's what we call driving while black sometimes.
Driving while black.
Yes, and I have a case now that is doing that in Kansas, and we hope the investigation is going on. And
so when people come into your office and they've got a case on their head, do you just literally just slap the book down on the table and say, shh, 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 just read? Don't say anything. Just read this book.
Yes. Sometimes I tell them, hey, I wish you know about my book before you start talking. And, you know, good enough, I have some clients during that period when I was writing the book. Those that doesn't talk, their case get dismissed in preliminary hearing. And those that talk, we have to go all the way. So
silence is golden. That is silence is power.
Is the
title of your book, A Lawyer's Step-by-Step Guide to Handling Police Interrogations and Protecting Your Freedom. Silence is Power. Our guest is Prince Adebayo Ogunmeno. He runs the Ogunmeno Law Firm. Thank you for joining us, Prince.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a quick break. When we return, a son reflects on his father's artwork and legacy on Central Standard. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. From playing cards in the day room of a military base to sketches of downtown Wichita to political cartoons to afternoons at Mexican markets, David Lighton's sketches and lithographs tell the story of a man in full and the living tapestry he leaves behind for a son to make sense of present and the world. Our guest right now is Robert E. Lighton, Vice President of Research and Policy at the Kauffman Foundation in Kansas City. He's usually presenting a paper on spearheading a conference on economic growth and prosperity, but he's here to talk about something different today. His father, the aforementioned David Lighton. Robert, welcome to the show.
That was a very generous introduction.
Well, welcome to the show. The exhibit is called From Wichita to the Wailing Wall, The Art of David Israel Lighton. That's your father. It features the original works of art reflecting the artist's Jewish faith and his pride as a Kansan. And it's going to be on display here at the Central Library in downtown Kansas City until February 26th. It's called Having Faith. Why do you call it that?
Because my father was a very deeply religious man. Not ostentatiously so, but something that where religion infused his daily life. He felt that that the Jewish religion is something that that guided him in everything that he did. But he was also very ecumenical. He was the president of the National Conference on Christians and Jews in Wichita for a number of years, and made great efforts to have outreach to both Christians and Jews to have each other explain each other's faith. And so while he drew a number of pieces that are in the book that I made for him and also will be in the show that I will be talking about on the library on January 31st, while he illustrated these Jewish themes, he also did some universally appealing themes. In fact, the cover of the book is of a man named the Kansan, and it's a man about to eat, and he's praying, and it's an image, I think it's an iconic image that would appeal to everyone of all faiths.
There is art with a Jewish theme that is prominent in this sketchbook, and it seems to strike you, and as you say, the sketches were chosen with care. What is it about your father's journey through art that reveals his faith? You mentioned he was very ecumenical and very even-tempered and even-handed and fair in his religious affiliations and in his worldview. But what does his art reveal vis-a-vis his faith?
Well, you know, art has a way of illustrating somebody's feelings from inside that pictures cannot. So it would be one thing if my dad just took pictures or if any of us took pictures of the subjects that we draw or that we saw. But when somebody draws, there's something emotional that comes out, at least to me, and I think a lot of people that bought his art, and there were a lot of people in Kansas while he was alive that bought his art. And so maybe it's just me as a son that, you know, with my own biases, that I see his faith being reflected in his works of art. But I think when people see the art itself, and actually they can buy the book at the library when they come, and the proceeds are all being donated to charity. But I think they'll get the same feeling that I get when I see his work.
Your father was in the oil business, yet he found the time to do these detailed sketches and beautiful works of art. Did he ever say why he didn't pursue life as an artist?
That's a very good question. My dad was a victim of, like many people of his generation, the greatest generation, of the Depression. And so when he graduated high school in 1928, he had an offer to attend the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Art, which would be the equivalent in Kansas City of going to the Kansas City Art Institute. And he was able to support himself for one semester, and that's all, because his father had also died in 1928, and he was from a family of five kids. And so he had to support the family by going into his father's business at the age of 16, and he wasn't able to go to art school, finish art school. And so all of his artwork after that was self-taught, although he went to the Wichita Art Association over many years while he was alive to practice, but it really wasn't to be taught because his skills were innate, and it was obvious that he had tremendous talent. I'm not sure how much more school would have helped him, although I'm sure if he had had a degree, he probably would have pursued a professional degree in art and not have gone to the oil business by accident, which is what happened.
Some of those hues and those moods and those angles don't look like stuff you can teach anyway. But
right.
But take us into your family home and how you came across these sketches. A very painful moment, but also a very illuminating one. You discovered sketches everywhere upon your father's death. Take us there.
Yeah, so I knew about my dad's art, obviously, because he was always drawing us while we were growing up, and I saw his lithographs that he did. But after the funeral, I came home, and there were family members around, and they started going through the house, through the closets and under the beds, and lo and behold, we found hundreds of pieces of art that were stored haphazardly throughout the house, mostly flat, though, so they were preserved. And there were a lot of art. There was a lot of art I had never seen, especially the art that he drew during World War II when he was stationed in Alaska, and it was just amazing because I had never seen this side of my father. And after the funeral, almost immediately, several people suggested that I had to make a book about his art, and I got the professional help here of a terrific art historian and also art teacher, a Professor Burton Dunbar, who's at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and he helped pick out the art that he felt was best, that would best illustrate my dad's work. But as you said, it was painful, but it also was very therapeutic for me to do the book because obviously I was grief-stricken when he died, even though he was 99, and the book is a way and able for me to tell a story to others that haven't seen his work, and I think that they appreciate it.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Robert Lighton is here discussing the life's work of his father, David Lighton, a visual artist and lithographer from Wichita, Kansas. The book is called Having Faith, The Collected Art of David Israel Lighton. What were your thoughts growing up of your father's sketches?
Well,
were they
kind of
just ubiquitous around the house, or did you actually take note when you were a kid?
Well, we knew it was a kid. I mean, we would sit down, and he would draw us and sketch us in 5 minutes and have these perfect sketches in almost no time. And there were some times when he had us sit down and pose, and there's actually one picture in the book of my brother and I when we're seven staring across a chessboard, and he painted us over several days, but he never put the chess pieces in. So it's an unfinished chess picture. But except for that, the art that we saw him do was always haphazard and random. And much of the art that he did, of course, we weren't around. But we knew that this is what he loved to do.
Is it lithographer or lithographer? This has been bothering me for a couple moments here.
Well, I think it's a lithographer, and actually it's very hard to do. You know, what you have to do
right.
is you have to draw something backwards on a stone.
Wow.
And then press this thing. You put the paper in with the ink, and then the paper comes out the other way. So the thought of drawing something backwards that you have drawn originally boggles the mind, and you have to be taught how to do this. And it's physically demanding, and it's obviously very difficult artistically.
It's actually a craft of art.
actually, he learned how to do that at the Art Museum, or at the Art Association of Wichita in the 1960s, and that's when he put out most of his work in the 60s and 70s.
Your father's detailed sketches of World War II events or non-events that seem to convey a beauty in banality, playing cards on the base, the downtime, planes on the ground instead of in the sky, and then these Kansas landscapes, some of them ominous, some of them very full of color. What story do they tell about the totality of your father's life?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. My dad had a very difficult life. He came from a very poor background. We were actually not well off while I was growing up. He was barely making ends meet. I mean, you can say you were in the oil business, but my dad had stripper oil, and it was very minimal income. And my dad actually didn't become financially comfortable until the 1970s, and it was by luck. And I think a lot of oil people become successful by luck. But the art was the soul of my dad. And that's something, you know, I'm going to give a talk on Tuesday night. I'm going to talk about how it's important to be remembered. All of us want to be remembered. And I think I'm lucky as a son that I have a way to remember my dad through his art that other people don't have the advantage of. In many ways, he was an ordinary man. He only had a high school education because he couldn't afford college. But he did extraordinary things and had extraordinary talent.
And how is his view of Kansas life, represented in these pieces?
Well, okay, so he grew up in Philadelphia and ended up here in the 1930s via Tulsa and eventually made his way to McPherson and then to Wichita. But he lived in Wichita for over 50 years, and my dad loved Kansas. And it's where I grew up. He didn't want to move anywhere else, even after my mother died in 1993. He loved somehow, even though the western Kansas, where a lot of his oil business was very bleak, he found something obviously peaceful and restful in it because he drew it. And it's a testament for all those who live in Kansas that there's something to be proud of in this state.
What was the reaction over the years to native Kansans and neighbors about his work? You said he sold some of his paintings. What were the reactions over the years?
Oh, I think everybody felt that they owned something special. And the reaction I've gotten since I've sent the copies of the book to a lot of the people who were his acquaintances, and there were two synagogues in Wichita that sold his art for benefit, so that they could benefit the synagogue. A lot of people who bought his book have sent me incredibly wonderful notes that this is something they'll treasure the rest of their lives. So it's been tremendously gratifying to me to know the reaction that people have had to his art.
There's another personal resonance. You mentioned your father having a good and hard life, but a rewarding life in terms of family and a passion for art, but also a lot of pain. He lost interest in sketching after your brother died in 1998. Describe that process.
Well, yeah, my mom died in 93, and my brother died in 98 when he was only 45. And between around that time, my dad, of course, was in his 80s. He still had skill, though. And he lost interest in painting. And understandably, as he got older, I think he was depressed. But toward the very end of his life, something happened. A light bulb went on. And especially in the last year of his life, he wanted to draw again. And he started drawing again. And even in the nursing home, before he died, he started drawing people in the nursing home until he broke his arm. And the book concludes with some very poignant pictures of me on his birthday, February 1st, which he incorrectly dated as 2012, thinking that he thought he was going to be 100. But in fact, he was 99. And then the last two pictures in the book before we get to the Canson are of his caregivers that he drew when he was 99, even with a broken arm. So even with a broken arm in 99, you could see that this man had talent. And it's something that happened to him before he died that this talent came rushing back, and this is what he wanted to do. I think it says something about all of us, that if you have a passion, it's something that never leaves you.
You have his sketch in the book, the sketch that he drew at the age of 99. It was his last sketch. describe for us what it is.
Well, it's of one of his caregivers, and it's very. I mean, it obviously doesn't have the skill of the earlier stuff that's in the book, but it's very touching. It's the last thing that I'll remember. And as I said, it's an indication that he did not. I mean, he did not want to leave this world without drawing. In fact, before he broke his arm, and he was in a nursing home. I actually had transferred him from a nursing home back to his house with 24/7 care. But while he was in the nursing home, one of the things he was looking forward to was drawing all the residents. And there were 250 people there. He was so excited that he could draw all these people. But then he broke his arm and wasn't able to, and that's when I moved him home.
Our guest is Robert Lighton. The book is called Having Faith, The Collected Art of David Israel Lighton, and the exhibit is From Wichita to the Wailing Wall. The Art of David Israel Lighton. It features original works of art reflecting that artist's Jewish faith and his pride as a Kansan. It's on display at the Central Library downtown Kansas City until February 26th. What do you plan to talk about today?
Well, actually, I'm going to give a talk on January 31st.
The 31st.
Yeah, it's at 6:30. And I'm going to show some of his art, you know, through a projector. And then I'm going to talk about his life in a little more detail than we've done here. Although I have to commend you. You've done a fabulous job because you've read the book cover to cover, I can tell.
I read all the books.
Well, you've done a great job.
That's what on Central Standard we read the books.
Okay, well, you did a great job. And so I'm going to be there to ask questions, and I'm sure people will have questions about Wichita, and we did come to Kansas City for vacations.
Right.
And people will be able to buy the book and some of the art and copies of the art, and all the benefits will go to the Kansas City Library.
Robert Lighton is the Vice President for Research and Policy at the Kauffman Foundation in Kansas City. He usually talks about economics, but today it was about his father, David Lighton. Once again, the book is called Having Faith, The Collected Art of David Israel Lighton. Thank you very much for joining us, Robert.
Couldn't thank you more. Thank you.
Tune in tomorrow as we get warp speed when we're joined by Star Trek legend George Takei, plus a band you might have seen on Tiny Desk Concerts, Lawrence's own Hospital Ships. We have help today from Tamika Weatherspoon. Our show is produced by Andreas Lindsay. Up to Date is next with a look at the advancements in the research of ALS disease. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.